Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
Welcome. I just got a text. We were going to talk about something else from my mom. It's a photo of a dead squirrel that my family dog just brought back and dropped at the foot of my dad's chair where he often sits.
Yep.
And we were just chatting. There's these funny things that people say, like, humans are the only animals who kill for sport. We're the only ones who commit genocide and war.
And there's a weird, and people know how we stand on animal ethics and animal rights. We tend to be very much proponents of it, but people romanticize nature,
yes,
and demonize human, and they act like we are the only people who murder for sport, have wars, kill out of vengeance, and that's just not the case. Like, nature is just as brutal in almost every way. So
Bart was fed well this morning. Went out, killed a squirrel, ate none of it, and brought it back. And it's
no, and I think people just don't know this. There's videos where a male zebra will drown baby zebras because they come from a different male.
Yeah,
and he wants only his babies around.
Yeah,
polar bears eat their young. Certain animals go to war.
Chimps can do wars. Ants do war. Anyway, it's not to say that they are worse than humans.
No, we don't have to belabor it. Yeah. I just thought it was interesting. It's like, yeah, we do sometimes have this Hakuna Matata. Life without humans would be absent suffering. And that's just not how nature works, which isn't to justify anything humans do that's fucked up. But it's just interesting context.
Yes. So I actually have a lot. I was in a very heady zone this week. A lot of reading and a lot of videos. Nice.
That's what happens when you don't have to make YouTube videos.
Yeah. So where do we start? Warren Farrell, I mentioned him to you. I watched a video on YouTube from Rebel Wisdom with this guy, Warren Farrell. I'd heard of him before. He's written a number of books, including The Myth of Male Power. When I heard of him, it was with negative connotation around his name. This is the guy who started all of that bitter incel stuff is kind of the...
Yeah, he's evil.
What I picked up about him. And I watched this and was struck, because I recognize him, by how tender he was. And I mentioned to you 20 minutes into the interview, he's kind of the guest of honor. There's one other woman, but he's by far the most famous. And there's a third panelist who is not famous. He goes, I just want to say you haven't had a chance to speak. Like... You know, and he brings this third younger woman panelist in. And as he's telling his story, it becomes clear he was very active in second wave feminism in the 60s and is truly, he's like wants equality.
Yeah.
His view of it is that gender roles evolved based on survival needs and we have evolved past them. Mm-hmm. So all of these customs and norms, which included at the time, his first one was like, we don't have enough girls in sports. We don't have enough women in the professions. Not that they have to be, but they need to be given the same sort of freedom to enter these and social allowance. Like it shouldn't be looked down upon.
So how did he switch from a very progressive feminist, like leading the feminist movement, to a men's right activist?
So this is the story. As he was on the board of Now, which is a women's organization, and started talking about equality for boys. And I forget exactly with regards to what, but you could imagine at the time there was a male only draft, and he was seeing. I remember now what it was. It was that when it came down to kids in divorces, he was like, let's do what's best for the kids. And the organization, because they were represented by women, were like, no, let's make sure that mothers are the default custodians. And that was where they split. And so he stopped getting invited to speak at feminist things. And his thing was not mothers shouldn't get Right.
You said the fact that your genitals shouldn't determine whether or not you get custody of a kid in a divorce.
And in fact, he was advocating in this case for less freedom for everybody. It's like, you can't leave the state if you have a divorce. Like the child needs access to their mother and father frequently, and you shouldn't be able to pick up and leave. So he was very much advocating, which is funny because children are both grow into both men and women. He wasn't anti-women or anti-men. He was pro the most vulnerable aspect of this relationship, but was summarily uninvited from a lot of events, no longer allowed to speak, and that was when he moved into the men's rights stuff, which was the flip side of it. So if women need to be encouraged to be in the workplace, males should be allowed to be stay-at-home's dad without any sort of social pressure, which I would say we haven't quite arrived at yet.
Well, you mentioned a little off-air, but he also would be a proponent of like splitting bills 50-50, yes, women getting drafted. He really just wants everyone to be treated the same. You don't even know the gender of someone. It's basically not in the real, like not when you're face to face, but in terms of the laws and things like that. Just don't have gender at all in law, basically.
I think what he's saying, gender roles served an important purpose for survival, but we have gotten past those, and he wants us to leave behind all of the old beliefs about what a man should do and what a woman should do insofar as they are no longer necessary to survival. So he talks about why we have women's studies but not men's studies. And then people respond, well, history is just men's studies. And I thought it was really interesting. He says, women's studies questions the female role. History sells the traditional male role of hero and performer. Women's studies tells women that they have the right to the traditional male role. Nothing tells men they have the right to the traditional female home, right to stay at home full or part time while the wife supports him. And I thought it was interesting because while history, we do often talk about men, his point is that it doesn't question that the idea of a great man
is Genghis Khan, Alexander the Great,
are people who
Roosevelt.
Yes, yes. There are no stay-at-home dads in history class. And so he's saying, look, we can tell history and we can include the quote-unquote great women who shaped Earth and the political climate that we're in. But what he's advocating for is a men's studies thing which questions the male gender role of provider and all of these.
The most interesting thing to me is how quickly he got demonized when he stuck with equality.
Yeah.
Like, because he was like all about equality, and he's being lauded in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah.
And then stuck with that line and quickly got demonized.
Yes. And what he says, which I think is an interesting point, and it's so unfortunate because it just marks the tribalism, is that he does seem to me someone who is interested in truth and is interested in what's best. So at one point he becomes a stepdad to a kid, and for this purpose he starts researching, like, what's the best way to be a stepdad? What do I do? And what he finds is the number one thing that he can do as a stepdad is facilitate a relationship between this child and their biological dad.
Wow.
And he's like, I was surprised, maybe a little bit disappointed to find that it wasn't about me. It was about this connection with one's biological father. Even though male role models are important, there is some sense of like, who am I? Where's the person that looks like me? Where is the pattern which I am following, and what does that say about me? And if that is empty and it is just a male figure, that's better than nothing, but it tends to correlate with worse outcomes.
Is that true of sons and daughters?
He says it is, in his research, it is particularly pronounced with sons.
Okay, because the way you're describing it,
it negatively impacts both.
The way you're describing it just made it seem like it was focused on sons. Because it's like, who am I supposed to emulate? Well, I assume the daughter doesn't emulate her father in many cases.
Well, I think this was actually a case of, I think his stepchild was a girl. But in any event, it negatively impacts both people to not have, both men and women to not have a relationship with their dad. So anyway, I took from that, I don't know the guy personally.
What a shitty takeaway if you're the stepdad.
Well, it's not that you can't do anything. You can still have a positive impact. But he's like, and he said, I was successful. I was able to make them have a closer relationship and ensure that the family did not drift away from the biological father. So I take from that, and again, these could be all just be stories he tells to butter me up or whatever, that he is genuinely interested in the truth of these things. He's got a couple other interesting things. Feminism as being primarily about class. He says, if you look at second, third wave feminism, what it is optimizing for is freedom, right? They want freedom to the traditional male role, which he fully supports, or the traditional female role, which he fully supports, or a mix and none of these, which he fully supports. What he does note is that in its current capacity of like free love, I want to work, that is primarily an upper class thing, which is to say that if you're lower class and you tend towards free love, do whatever I want, you will wind up pregnant and you will not be able to pay someone to facilitate the the caretaking of that child. Versus if you're upper class, you're more likely to use birth control. If you do get pregnant, you're more likely to be able to pay an au pair or a nanny to take care of it. So he just comments on how feminism, as we've seen it, as this total freedom, has problems and has been localized to one class and perhaps even more dangerous is seeking freedom from everything, which makes sense. But the one freedom that he does not want men or women either to be able to escape is the freedom from being an active parent.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, I'm all for freedom up and until children are involved. And at that point, your freedom needs to be severely curtailed. You can't leave the state. You can't do this. You can't move away from, like, all of a sudden, the rights of the child supersede everything else. So it's just interesting. I'm only one chapter in. I can't talk too much about it. So I don't know if we should title this episode The Myth of Male Power or the next one. But I've just started reading it, and it's very interesting. I find myself underlining often because there's a lot of things that I hadn't thought about. Let me see if there's anything else in here real quick. Yeah, divorce, all that kind of stuff. Oh, just a handful of other things early on. We've mentioned this in the past. The idea of he talks about power dynamics. It's 1993. He's ahead of his time, and he talks about how women in the workplace often perceive power dynamics as being male-dominated because in the workplace, in 1993 especially, power was held by men.
Mm-hmm.
But he says what women don't see is that at the opposite end of the spectrum, they don't even consider their garbage man. They don't even consider all of these people who they do not work with. So they think, oh, men have power, but they're neglecting that they are looking at the top percentage of men who do in fact have power and ignoring the roofers, crab fishermen, frontline soldiers, all of these people who feel very powerless in society. Mm. And so his whole point is like, look, history has been rough to men and women in different ways. And we need to start to understand these different ways. So I can keep elaborating, but he does exercises at his events where, for instance, all the men come on stage, he has them take off their shirts, and he has the women criticize and pick apart the way that they look, you know, just to down to the nittiest gritty thing, to give them an experience of what it is like, just for a moment, to feel the gaze of the world like mm-hmm. women often do. And then he takes women on stage, and he ranks them in order of highest earner to lowest earner. And then he takes like the bottom 60% and says, you are all losers. I want everyone to look at these people and let them know that they have failed in their duty as a woman because, mm-hmm. and like just to facilitate, oh God, like I'm keenly aware of the problems and the pressures of my own life, but I'm utterly blind to what somebody else might feel. So it's just very interesting so far.
Well, you had mentioned something similar about how when you look at the past and you think about men, you get the sense that men had power in the past because the most powerful people were men.
Mm-hmm.
But that treating men as a monolith is a little bit strange because also every person brutally murdered on the front lines of battle was a man. And you were much more likely to survive to a certain age mm-hmm. and have children if you were a woman.
Yeah.
Like most men were just getting killed off before then, basically.
Yes.
So history... Just treating, I mean, this is like a common refrain we have on the podcast, treating anyone as a monolith based on gender, race, yeah. sexuality is a little bit silly and kind of falls apart because some men had power mm-hmm. and a lot of men did not.
Yes, yes. And I think he says something like, the core flaw of feminism is that assuming that because women felt powerless that men must have had power. And again, you can understand it in the context of like, oh my gosh, all the presidents are men and the CEOs are men and the big movers and shakers. But it's like you got to look at the guys who were building the skyscrapers 100 well, stories yeah, in the air and like funny. Laying down the railroad spikes. And
I kind of feel like a lot of this is just a trick to make people not look at class, to not look at wealth. Because if you look through history, it's like, who are the most powerful people?
Mm-hmm.
Wealthy men. Who are the second most wealthy or most powerful people? Second most powerful. Wealthy women married to wealthy men, right? They're going to have a better quality of life than the coal miners.
Mm-hmm.
So it just seems like anytime we're trying to divide ourselves, it often feels like that's the best way to divide ourselves.
There's a couple of, I agree that I've heard it said that like feminism is just, we've talked about this, is just consumerism evolving, which is to say, you know what would be cool? If women needed to buy a bunch of stuff to go to work, including clothes, and had extra disposable money so that they could contribute to buying more stuff that they don't need in order to succeed in the rat race. So mm-hmm. it's just an evolution of consumerism. But it's also like there's a core flaw, which is that power and happiness is a zero-sum game. And it's not totally wrong. It's like, look, it is nicer to have people do things for you than to be the servant, obviously. Mm-hmm. But even assuming that because the poor people are miserable, that the rich people must have therefore been, I know this is controversial, better off meaningfully. And we've talked about this. We live in a world where rich people are literally committing suicide. You know, we talked about Avicii, and you can start naming your favorite celebrity that had everything and killed themselves. It is, it's confused. And the second thing is, it's like, it's so weird how easy it is to band into tribes. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, all the women come together and all the men come together and they all decide that they hate each other and they air their grievances and they feel camaraderie in hating someone where it doesn't make sense. It's almost ludicrous to view history, and now that I've viewed it this way, as primarily about conflict between men and women. It's like, you do realize that every human who ever was birthed came from the union of a man and a woman, and that all of these societies where you could view it as women being in an inferior role, and in many ways they were controlled, were subjugating entire other tribes in far harsher ways, literally exterminating them when given the chance. So to say that it's primarily men versus women and not tribe versus tribe or nature versus people seems myopic.
Yeah, I agree.
But it's interesting. I'll get deeper into the book. We could talk about it as I go. Was there anything else? Yeah. He often just talks about the opposite of all these terms that we have. So he says we talk about the glass ceiling, but we don't talk about the glass cellar, which is the bottom, you know, all these bottom jobs. We talk about the power that men have, but we don't talk about the genetic celebrity of women. And he does seem like someone who is just like, he just wants to see men staying at home and women playing in sports and women being presidents. And he's like,
and women getting drafted.
And women getting drafted. And I think he would say that there are areas where it does not make sense. It's like, look, if you are doing the job of a firefighter and your job is to carry a unconscious person out of a building, I don't care if you're a man and a woman, but you need to be able to lift 180 pounds.
But that's still a gender neutral policy.
Yes, but the outcome would
still. Well, I think outcomes is the dumbest thing to look at.
Well, he is concerned with outcomes. He's like, we don't have enough women playing sports. And he's like, I think that we could if they were encouraged. And that's what we've seen, is that women's sports has grown tremendously since the 60s. Interesting stuff. Do you want to hop in with something? We got a lot of stuff.
Sure. I mean, this is quick. Have you ever seen the movie Defiance?
You mentioned it.
World War II movie. Really good for gratitude, mm-hmm. I'd say. It's about this. So basically, it's World War II. It's the Holocaust. It's this Jewish family. I'll keep the spoilers light, but they come home. Their mom and dad have been murdered. So they have to run. Basically, what was happening is in Russia, as the German front was moving forward, cities went from being safe to unsafe. And when they became unsafe, Jews were immediately put in the ghetto, sent to concentration camps, or killed immediately. And so they have to flee into this forest that they know well because they grew up in the area. And then slowly, I'll try not to ruin the movie because I really recommend everyone watch it, but they amass more people. And they end up inadvertently taking responsibility for this community of Jews living in the forest. And life is hard. I mean, it's just a movie, but you really, it gives you the sense of like, yeah, they're trying to survive in the forest, in the winter, in Russia, going days without eating, being hunted down. It is brutal. And you watch it and you immediately feel bad for anything you've complained about your own life that you can remember.
Yeah.
And so it's a great movie, high score on Rotten Tomatoes, like well worth watching. Also, it gives some context for things like Trump is the next Hitler. It's like, yeah, we really kind of are downplaying what Hitler did. And at the same time, it's just made me very, very grateful. It's a good movie for making you feel very lucky that you're not a Jew in World War II in Russia.
Yeah. A serious question. Do you think that the suffering that you have had in your life subjectively felt is less than?
Yeah.
You do?
Yeah, I do. As I watched it, I said that woman who said suffering is equal regardless of circumstance, mm-hmm. I think if I could rephrase what she was saying.
Well, I don't think she said suffering. Is it? She said you cannot compare suffering.
You cannot compare suffering. Here's what I'd say. Maybe Avicii did suffer as much as a concentration camp person.
Got it.
Because his mental makeup was, he got dealt a bad brain hand. Mm-hmm. And so maybe that one rich person suffered. But if you took all the middle upper middle class people in America, and then you took all the people in concentration camps, I think the amount of suffering felt day to day over the course of a year, way higher in the concentration camps. So actually, as I was watching this, I was like, I don't think I have suffered mentally anything near being 3 days without food and then having to evacuate the home I just built in the woods and flee as gunshots come before me and then watch a kid die and then find out that my wife, who I'd sent to a safer city deeper into Russia, had also been conquered and my son was murdered and I wasn't even there to see it. It's like, no, in my entire life, I have not suffered anywhere near that. So yeah, that was actually my, I actually reflected on that book and I said, maybe this is true in the, by saying some people who you think have less lives suffer just as much as concentration camp victims. But on the whole, like
on average, yeah,
I don't think there was a single person in the concentration camp on the Jewish side, maybe on the soldier side there was, but a single person suffering there who suffered less than I have in the last 12 months.
Yeah. Well, a question about that, and I don't know the answer. I wonder, because some of the things that you called, like there's deprivation, there's starvation, 3 days without food, there's pain, there's all of those things. And you also mentioned loss, loved ones. So what if we held the loss constant and said someone whose mother died when they were young and then, you know, I mean, we have a friend who lost a lot of close family members. Like,
well, I'll say, so my grandpa, his son died and it's tragic, a lot of suffering. And it fucks you up. And I think it would be what the woman, the author you're talking about, the Holocaust survivor, was referencing in terms of you can suffer even if your financial situation is good. Like, he was having that suffering. And I think probably suffered less than if he had had the same loss, plus also had lost his wife, also hadn't eaten in 3 days, also had just fled his home and seen friends gunned down as they flee through the forest. Like, yes, he's suffering. And you don't want to compare suffering, but I still don't think he suffered as much as some of the people. Like, maybe someone in the forest suffered less than him when he lost his son, but someone in the forest suffered worse, would be my guess. So I'm not a Holocaust survivor. That woman is. I'm not trying to say she's wrong, but I think maybe the nuance is, yes, people who look like they have it good can suffer as badly as people who look like they have it bad. But I'm watching this and I go, no one I know has had it this rough.
Yeah. So let's take Holocaust aside and just say, pick a time in the last, you know, over 100 years ago with, you know, with between 1400 and 1900 or whatever, or even between 900 and 1400. And just drop down and pick a random person. This is the question that I don't know the answer to. Is the average subjective experience of life reported, would it be, if you could have surveys, would people report the same level of satisfaction, happiness, et cetera, a lower level or a higher level? And I honestly don't know. Now, certainly we can say,
in 1400 versus today?
Yeah. I don't know. And then some people go back and they say, let's go back 10,000 years ago, pre-agriculture. You're getting picked off by fucking, you know, savanna predators, but you also are,
well, you don't know anybody.
20 hours of leisure a day.
Yeah. No, I think so. I think savanna leisure might be happier than people today.
Well, this is the question. As like technology, has technology enabled us to survive longer?
But I think being a Uyghur in China
is
worse than being someone in America. Like, I do think circumstance dictates
subjective suffering experience.
And subjective experience. Yeah.
That's, well, so that is my experience of it, obviously, to a degree. It's like, look, there are things that I...
Oh, but what I'm saying is I think that woman would agree.
Yeah.
This added nuance. I think there's nuance to what she's saying, and I think she would agree. And she'd say, if you feel like on the whole you've suffered less than a Uyghur, you probably have. And even when you were sad about a breakup or something, you were not as sad as someone who's... like that's. I don't think that's what she was saying in hindsight. I think what she was saying is, for the suicidal, their suffering isn't to be scoffed at. And it's silly to look at their circumstances and say, well, why would that person commit suicide? Because they're rich. But I struggle to imagine anyone who would say suffering is agnostic to circumstance.
Well, you could imagine Buddhists who might argue that and say it.
They well, they could say suffering could be agnostic to circumstance, but they would also say life is suffering. And so I think your subjective suffering is impacted by your circumstances.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm confused. you had mentioned, I didn't watch it. I don't know if you wanted to talk about this. The Marvel good guys not being held accountable.
Oh, well, this was, it's not the good guys necessarily not being held accountable. It's interesting. So I watched WandaVision.
So let's pause. You gave spoilers for Defiance, whatever. Nobody cares. Nobody's going to watch it.
Yeah.
This is Falcon Winter Soldier. No, this is what I'm going to say.
So, well, first of all, everyone should, I strongly recommend watching Defiance. Yeah. But so yeah, we're about to give spoilers for WandaVision and for Falcon and the Winter Soldier. But the thing I find interesting about those shows is how they, who they try to paint the good guy as. And we talked about it a little bit, but it's whoever the camera follows and also what the music does while you're watching them. Because in this new Captain America and the Winter Soldier, they're trying, at least for now, I hope he has a redemption arc, but they're trying to paint the new Captain America as a bad guy. And the scene they use to do it is he is trying to stop super soldier terrorists. So these are Captain America level strong people who have tied up people to rob a building. And then when they easily could have escaped, burn the building down and killed everyone there, burn them alive. And the logic that they use is this is the only language the strong hear or whatever. It's so, it's such a weak thing, but they try to make you sympathetic to this group. So he goes in to try to stop them. Their plan is to kill him. They don't know he's a super soldier. Spoilers, he got some serum. But their plan is to nine super soldiers against two normal people, murder them both. They do kill his friend, but not him. He catches one of the people and he murders the terrorist. And that's the scene you're supposed to see him as a bad guy, because he does it with the shield. And he does it by lifting the shield up and then killing the guy. And then there's blood on Captain America's shield. And Captain America would never do this. And the music that's playing is angry. And I'm watching it going, how could you possibly think this guy's the bad guy? He got chosen because he's a decorated Marine. He served in the Middle East for years and won medals. Do we think he's never killed someone before? Do we think this was his first time killing someone who's bad? And the
we can put bad in quotes, and yes, they did bad, you know, an enemy at this point.
Sure. He and the guy, they try to make it even worse because the guy's sitting on the ground begging for his life, saying, I wasn't the one that pulled the trigger. I wasn't the one that pulled the trigger. Do we not think that happens all the time on both sides? Every time someone gets captured and then killed afterwards, that they don't beg for their life at some point. So I'm watching this. I'm going, this is just a Marine doing Marine things. This is just a Marine killing a terrorist who tried to murder him and then begged for his life once he lost the fight.
Yeah. Well, we also, I haven't seen that at all. After WandaVision, I was disappointed and I haven't watched Winter Soldier.
Then this is the second thing you're gonna point out is Captain America, I'm pretty sure, has killed people. He just kills them off screen.
Without blood.
Yes.
So I recalled the first scene it's awesome because his first Captain America for me was disappointing. And then Winter Soldier comes and they're like, no, Cap is cool. And he lands on this boat and he front kicks a guy so hard that I'd have to watch the scene back. Maybe we can find it. Front kicks him so hard that he slams into the side of this
metal pole
from probably 20 feet away, and then maybe even goes off the edge. So he's got a broken spine and maybe drowns if he goes off the edge.
No, he goes off the edge. He does. Yeah. He's paralyzed, drowning to death. He's just realized he can't use his legs and is now drowning
to
death.
It's like, did that guy pull the trigger? I mean, Cap just destroys people.
He also has a gun in the first movie. Yeah. So I know you don't see what he's shooting at, but you see him shooting at enemies.
Yes.
Does he just have terrible aim?
No, and a few times where they show you, it's like a guy in a robot suit. It's like they dehumanize them all. And then they just take, please. Like, that's the first time that an enemy didn't want to die or had a confused reason for doing what they did.
I also think Cap has probably thrown people off of roofs. At one point, he crashes battleships that have humans on them, I believe. So any human that's on that battleship is going to die. He's just killed hundreds of people, but never with bad person music
never
playing
with
and never
blood
with
and
blood.
Music. Yeah. And I've felt disappointed in the way that Disney has handled good and evil, which is like, of course they are. But then I'm thinking back to WandaVision, where Wanda, the plot, spoilers, takes over an entire town in her grief of her loss of vision and tortures them for we don't know how long. It's at least days, if not weeks. At one point, one of these mind-controlled people is freed, and they beg, please get me out of here, please.
I mean, one of them literally says, if you're not going to free me, kill me.
Kill me.
This is worse than death.
Yes, this is
worse
than death.
She does this to 1,000 people, including children.
Yes, and she's understandably sad and grieving, and does this and is warned about it and realizes what she's doing and doesn't come. And then finally, at the end of it, in the final episode, lets these people go. And the message to her from the supporting characters, they'll never know what you did for them, which is to say, you kidnapped and tortured them and eventually let them go. Like, imagine if that was the way that we treated kidnap and torturers. It's like, look, you have 30 days to release the victim, in which case you're a good person. Yeah. It's ludicrous. It's insane. And instead of taking it the interesting route of like, Wanda's bad. Like yes, Wanda had not
or
bad.
Gray.
Gray. She had horrible things happen to her, has way too much power, couldn't handle it, and hurt a lot of people. Nah. You know, like, they'll never know.
And now she'll just go on to be a protagonist in the next movie.
Or, like, you know, they'll just switch it up. But it's the same sort of, it's just disappointing. And what it says, unfortunately, I think about the audience is like, you don't have moral principles. You don't. What you have are completely manipulatable emotions, and all I need to do is play the right music and I can tell you who was good and who was bad. And that is a damning assessment.
Yeah,
if mainstream audience.
If most people think Wanda is still the good guy, and
that's what Disney thinks of its audience, regardless.
Sure.
Disney thinks its audience will buy that.
Yes.
Which is to say, I mean, it's an interesting way to view commercials and media, is like, this is what the writer thinks about you. You know, they're writing this for you.
Yeah,
this is what they think you'll buy.
They think you'll forgive torturing thousands of people for days on end as long as we play the right music and follow them around with the camera. Yeah, they think that you'll damn a Marine for killing one person.
If there's blood on
it. If there's blood and we play the right music.
And we give you any information about the reasons of the terrorist doing it. And I think you mentioned that the terrorist was also made a woman to make her more sympathetic.
Yeah, in the comics, the leader of the terrorist organization is a man, and they switch her to a woman in the show, I think, in an effort to try to make her more sympathetic.
Yeah.
But the other thing is, if you have this empathy, I would recognize that all the real world terrorists also have what they think are good reasons.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's the weird thing, is to root for this woman, think that this is a bad Captain America because he murdered someone, while the old Captain America definitely murdered people, while this person was a Marine commended for murdering people, and while in the real world, you damn terrorists whose reasons are, I think, probably tied with this TV group. All of that is happening in the same brain, and that's what I find interesting. Someone doesn't like the real world terrorists, likes the TV terrorists, likes old Cap, doesn't like this new Cap.
Well, even within this, you're saying like this loaded word of terrorist. I don't want to harp on it too much, but it has its judge, jury, and executioner right off the bat. You know what I mean? Like,
I'm using it in the literal sense. This group is trying to create, they're trying to accomplish something by creating fear. Mm-hmm. That's why they burned 14 people alive.
Sure, but if that's how we use the word terrorist and we used it evenly, the president of the United States, anytime the president says there will be a sanction, that's terrorism. He makes you know what I mean? Like, if that's how we want to use the word terrorist and we want to evenly apply it, we just populated the world with a lot of terrorists.
Sure.
And if the way that you deal with terrorists is you don't negotiate and you do all this, it's like, okay, well, now we don't negotiate with the president of the United States.
Well,
based
I mean,
on your
often,
own principle
often
reflected
I think
back upon you.
Terrorist versus freedom fighter, revolutionary versus dissident. It just depends where you're standing.
The idea that using fear as a way of control, as a unique means of warfare, is also goofy. And it also contains within it, it's like, no, the way you're supposed to fight is with your tanks. Well, you don't have any tanks. You know what I mean? Like, you're supposed to use drones in order to fight. It's classic the British when there was the American Revolution, which again, we call it the American Revolution. I've heard that some have called it the War of American Aggression across the pond. The way that they talked about the guerrilla fighters was with disdain because they wouldn't stand in a line.
Yeah, of course, we have more soldiers than you, so the most fair thing to do,
is to stand in a line and shoot each other.
Well, we have less soldiers than you, so the most fair thing to do is to kill you
in
our woods.
And shoot your officers.
Yeah.
It's like, well, that's not right. And again, so it's just, just a lot of people in conflict, and some of the conflict is over the assertion of who is good and who is evil, and much of that is done with principles that do not hold up if they were universalized.
Yeah, that's the thing. When I was watching it, I was just annoyed with the fact that through music, they were trying to make me think this person was a bad person for murdering one person that had just tried to kill him. It's like, well, wait, but then I should have thought he was a bad person for being a Marine, and I should have thought Captain America was a bad person, mm-hmm. and this just doesn't hold up. Mm-hmm. And so that's where I thought it was something interesting and also like very inconsistent.
Sure. Moving along?
Sure.
I had a dream.
All right, Martin Luther King.
I had a full podcast in our dream. There were some interesting topics. I couldn't write them all down afterwards. And I'm sure you know how you have a dream and you think you have brilliant ideas.
Yeah.
This is so dumb. This one is, I think, accurate.
Talking to the mic.
It's close to accurate. So for whatever reason, I was thinking about war and why we don't have interstate war, right? Like why Pennsylvania doesn't go to war with New Jersey. And I think there was probably a time in American history where that was not a given. It wasn't, you know.
Definitely.
And the reason, as far as I can tell, is that we had enough cultural in common that we felt comfortable enough to give a larger organization a standing army. Mm-hmm. That was more powerful than ours. And so if you look at the way that peace is often achieved, whether it's within a community who gives this to the police, it's like who has a monopoly on the use of legitimate force? Mm-hmm. And not just legitimate force, like who has all the guns? You know, who can control this? So if you look at the world, and I know that this is like the globalists and the big world powers, but eventually I imagine that might be 500 years down the line, if we get to an area where economics tie us tightly enough that cultural differences don't matter as much, and we create a UN with a standing army that is far more powerful than any particular nation's standing army, you will end wars as effectively as federal governments can end state wars.
Yeah.
And obviously that's not something you want to rush towards, because we're seeing even in America right now, it's like, oh shit, states are different and we've got different things. So it's like, when can we reasonably kick power up a level? But it was just like, this is how you end war, is you get to a point culturally where you feel comfortable enough just going, we are going to each give up our guns. We're going to give them to somebody else.
No, there's 50 states.
Answerable to both of us.
Any one state tries to fight another state, the other 49 states will send their soldiers and you'll get smashed.
But it's not even the 49 states. It's that this federal entity has an army that is not like, if I go to war and I'm from Pennsylvania, it's not like the Pennsylvania militia can call me back at that. It's I am a soldier of the US federal government at that point. So anyway, I know that.
Do people not like globalism? Because I feel like that's where we're going. And I also feel like it has pretty obvious upsides. What's the people don't like about
I think globalism? That your local needs will be superseded by a group of elites telling you what is best for you is, I think, the problem. And also it's like, look, if you went back to 500 and we're like, we're going to make nation states now, you know, 580, it's like, this is not going to work. You know, you need economic advancements, technological advancements, cultural advancements. But what's interesting is like, we started this federal democracy without electronics. Like Benjamin Franklin was flying the kite, like, oh, electricity isn't lightning. That's how far back that was.
Yeah, we were writing letters.
It's wild. And it's like, man, there's huge democratic advancements that could be made with, can I vote on my phone, please? You know what I mean? Like, when is this going to happen? And obviously there's all these problems of who tracks the phone data and all these things need to be sorted out and are serious questions. But it seems inevitable to me that if we do not kill ourselves, that we will continue to congeal. And some people say, no, we're eventually going to fragment into tribes, but it seems that technology allows larger groups of people to band together under common interests, as does increasing economic ties.
I agree.
And yeah. And then in 500 years, there might be this one world army that goes in and, you know, it, and
500 years. If I got to bet, I'd bet it would. If I could put $1,000 down on an even odds bet, 500 years.
Wouldn't be worth any money.
No, I know, but I'm thinking if someone could just come back there and say, yeah, you're right or you're wrong, some genie situation. Yeah, I would definitely bet we have one world, kind of United States of the world situation.
And then you know what we'll have is all those people on Mars will have their own. And we will be different enough from those people on Mars that there will be two large superpowers. Yeah. And then there will be a couple other colonies on different moons and shit. And just like Russia and the United States, we'll start being like, this is ours and this is ours. And we could just repeat the cycle over and over again. But it seems that that's what the cycle does. It starts in tribes and it moves to larger communities. Then it moves to states and then, you know, continents and all that kind of stuff. But to be fair, for those of you listening, it does look, if you look very closely at our time, like the United States is having trouble with its federalness. England just left the EU. Like some of these larger things are breaking down. And even though they might move backwards in the short term, I do think 500 years.
Yeah, progress often looks like a jagged line going upwards, if that makes sense. Things take step backwards, but I think you will continue to progress forwards to more unity while taking steps back such that 2030 might be less united than 2010.
Yeah.
But still, the long-term trend, I think, will be towards unity.
Yep. Yep. Do you want to do one?
Well, yeah. Do you want to talk about Karen Nazario, the guy that was pepper sprayed in his car?
I don't know anything.
Okay. Well, so this was just a lawyer friend contacted me to kind of weigh in on this because he knows we have a podcast, so we don't have to talk about it much. I did watch the video. It looks like the cops are way out of line. It's wild. Stepping back from the actual case, because, you know, details are being argued in court, there were two things my lawyer friend brought up that we've talked about a little bit, but the idea that we don't have national body cam policies and we don't have huge penalties for lying in police reports is very interesting because he's a lawyer. He's a criminal defense lawyer. And he says it's, you almost expect the police report to contain fabrications.
Yeah.
Not, and you can imagine a system where you think the police report is 100% accurate because there's a massive penalty for lying in a police report. I'm sure there's an argument as to why, like people misremember things when they're in high stress situations and you don't want to imprison police if they're trying their best. But we don't even need to belabor it. I just thought it was interesting. He's in the criminal defense system and basically said he finds it really hard to understand why there's such leniency for lying in police reports and having body cam malfunctions.
Yeah, I know nothing about it, but it seems to me that if there is a system with uneven risk on either sides where one party is given the weapon leniency if they lie, you know, it's like that is a system ripe for corruption. So I don't know anything about this. The body cam stuff we've talked about seems very obvious. Penalties for lying. I mean, this is the same issue that you get with anything is, look, if we can't prove that you lied and it's unclear, you walk. Okay. But if like we can demonstrate, we can prove fraud or anything, if that obviously should be wrong. Now, I don't know if that's already on the books. It might be.
That's the thing. I don't know. He's saying that it's not.
I don't know. It may or may not be. But what I do take is like, man, off this focus again on police, you know, here we go. And why police? Is this how most Americans die? Not even fucking close. Is this how most Americans are maimed? Not even fucking close. Like, why do we keep hearing about this? And my answer is the news does not give two dams about saving lives or the welfare of people. It doesn't care. If it did, what you would do is start blindly from, okay, what is harming the most people? And if you want to narrow it, what is harming the most Americans? Mm-hmm. You would start at the top of the list and you'd be like, holy crap, it's refined sugar all the way down. It's heart attacks and diabetes and this, and we'd be all over it and we could save millions of lives.
Yeah. Well, that's the COVID
action.
That's the COVID point that's interesting is we have a COVID death counter that runs on all the news stations. I see this in the gym. It's the only reason I see it. It's just constantly updating you on how many people have died from COVID. But it would be really useful to have maybe a top five thing. So the timer for COVID can stay, but you just see it above or below other things so that you have context for how many people are also dying from the number one cause of death, which is not COVID. And then you see COVID and then you'd see what's closely behind it.
Yeah.
But they're just not, that's not the goal of the news. The goal of the news is not to inform people or to improve the lives of American.
No. I mean, citizens. Can you imagine if there were, I mean, individual cases of people with diabetes and heart attacks and the amount of food that they ate at McDonald's and how McDonald's served them four burgers in one day and then they had a heart attack. Like this stuff happens, you know, in the same, but no one in media is interested in picking it up. And I actually think that this is a side where the supply will meet the demand because the asymmetry is on the side of like, we have dumb reptile brains that like see images and think they are representative. And the news has the selection.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Of everything that has occurred. And if they want to put diabetes and people dying and all this kind of stuff, that's what will happen. And that's what people will panic and care about. Now, there, of course, is a relation where sometimes people get bored of stuff. But like, People would be bored of this if the news were simply searching for ratings and was just perfectly optimizing for ratings. I think they could find other ways to do it. There's other things to be outraged. Actually, I take that back, because this has an individual agent that can be held responsible. It's a horrifying scene that might hit really well on what makes people react. But in any event, the fact that we're talking about police constantly and talking about, you know, how many people are harmed in a year by police without relating that to other causes of harm that can be mitigated is, to me, very strong evidence that this is not a good faith actor, and this is not how we should be even starting the conversation. Now, as it gets to police and we get there, I'm probably in favor of all the things you said. Like, let's do body cam footage. Let's sue the crap out of the precinct of anybody whose body footage turns off. You know, let's have all of these additional rules. Yes, but I don't know. It seems like we're missing the things that are killing and hurting the most people in order to remain focused on this pet problem. Do you know?
Well, it's also for some of the leading causes of death in the U.S., like heart disease and cancer, you also run into the fact that there's a push against identifying the problem. So people are saying that obese is a slur.
Not people. Twitch is now like not allowing you to say.
But that's the thing. That's
Twitch
a platform.
Is insane.
That's a platform.
No, and you can say obese, but you can't, like, in the chat, you're not allowed to say it. I don't know what the rule is, but it was just one guy discovered that he couldn't enter it into the chat in terms of voting, and now that was the story. So I have to confirm.
Okay. What I'm saying is you're laughing because obese is right now being considered a slur. And people are pushing back and saying, you can't make obese a slur. It's a technical term. It's a medical term. Well, we have an R word that I won't say because I don't want to get canceled for people with a certain level IQ.
Yeah.
It is also a technical term.
Yeah.
And you can't say it. And so the number one causes of death in America are actually heart disease and cancer and things of that nature. But I wonder if part of the reason that that will never get talked about is because...
I think you're allowed to say the R word if you mean it technically. If you're like, hey, this is my brother. His IQ is 65. He is... I think you're okay.
Okay. I'm just telling you that there have already been technical medical terms taken out of the context of conversation. And there's a push, at least, to make it so that you can't fat shame people, so that you can't talk about weight, so that you can't talk about obesity. How are you going to talk about, if you're a news station, how are you going to talk about the fact that the leading cause of death is weight if you're not allowed to mention weight?
Well, no, I think you're oversimplifying it. The reason that Twitch did it, which I disagree with, is not because people were having scholarly conversations about BMI. It's because they were being purposefully mean to fat people, which I guess we can call them fat, but not they were using that as a mean term.
Sure.
And the reason that the R word is now a bad word is not because people were describing their loved ones who have low IQs. It's because they were using it to take people that were not technically medically within that category and to put them down.
What I'm saying is that you're talking about the news spending more time covering heart disease and cancer and things of that nature, since that's what kills most Americans. What I'm telling you is there is a movement in America that it's not a bad thing to be 300 pounds, 400 pounds.
I wonder how significant that movement is. I've heard it and seen it, and it was on the Cosmo magazine.
People make up 0.6% of the population.
Sure, sure.
And the movement for trans rights is really large. What I'm saying is we're at the first domino of 300 pound and 400 pound people saying, you can't tell me this is unhealthy. It's shaming me. It's slurring me to tell me this is unhealthy.
Maybe
that this is the wrong way to live.
You might be right.
I see more of that than I do of people saying that the number one problem in America is people having excessive amounts of fat to the point that it strains their body and kills them.
Yeah.
Which is not at all in the mainstream media. It's not at all in the magazine. Like, no one's talking about that.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of the two sides fighting, it feels like in the media, there's much more push to not fat shame, not bring up the word obesity, not make people feel bad than there is to save lives by harping on nutrition and diet and exercise and all that stuff.
Sure. That
so I don't think we'll ever see the news talk about heart disease the way that they talk about coronavirus.
or to take individual cases of egregious examples of companies enabling that sort of, like, why don't we just go
to have a death counter?
Like, isn't there a TV show like My 1,000-Pound Life? Like, why aren't we going to TLC and in the same way, like, is this not worse than pepper spray? Like making a spectacle of this really, really dangerous health situation. I don't know which way. It seems to be pretty awful. That's totally fine. And to be clear, I'm not saying that cops should pepper spray people that don't deserve it. That is a no-no. Don't do that.
Yeah, I'm just saying I don't think we'll see the news cover the number one cause of death in America the way that they cover COVID or police murders or anything of that nature. Yeah, I think it will just never be the focus of the media.
Yes. Yes. Seems to be a power game. I think that's all that I had. Do you have anything else?
I'm Googling now the number one cause of death in America, but
I looked up the top 10. I think it's heart disease.
I don't know. I was looking up annual deaths the other day in
there,
the gym.
If you look at them and you go, which of these are strongly related to diet and exercise? It's like down the list. And it's you could save a lot of lives by having a government public focus on diet and exercise and what's unhealthy. And like, we've mentioned this, but I remember growing up and like fat was the thing to be avoided because unfortunately when eating fat is associated, it's got the same word as the fat that's on your body that makes people not like you as much because you're not attractive or it is just not what you want. But what was never really explained was like, this isn't, you don't like eat this well, and it goes to your body.
There's healthy fats that you can eat that are good for you. And then there's also sugar, which is bad for you.
Bread. And it's not necessarily
also
bad
just to be
you.
Clear though, people will disagree that sugar causes cancer.
Sure.
Or causes
and
heart
not
disease.
Even, and it might not even be the cane sugar that is the problem. It might be the high fructose corn syrup and the sucrose.
Diet causes cancer. People might push back on. That's what I'm saying.
Who? I'd be surprised to hear that. That seems like
people in the comments might even.
Sure, maybe. That seems to me to be a fringe.
I agree, but
I've only read Blue Zones and Anti-Cancer. So
no, my perspective is that diet has an impact on heart disease and cancer. But I'm just saying, I don't even think that that's something you get to say and not get disagreed with.
Sure. Anyways.
I had one more thing. Ben Askren is incredibly likable. He's fighting Jake Paul this Saturday, so he's been doing a bunch of interviews. Have you seen him?
No.
That guy is...
It's funny because I didn't like him at all with the run-up to the Jorge fight.
He is so centered. It is unbelievable. So he goes on the Logan Paul podcast, which I thought was very smart of Logan because obviously it's getting 5 times more views than his other podcasts. And he goes on there and the Paul, you know, Logan Paul and Mike and George, they're on Jake's side. They want Ben to lose and they make that very clear and they're trying to get a rise out of him and they talk to him about did you have to apologize to them for being such a loser when you lost the Jorge fight? Do your kids, when you're at wrestling camp, tease you for getting knocked out? They're just trying to get under his skin. When I watch you box, I'm going to be honest, you look slow. It looks sad. And he's just, so they do make fun of me for that knockout. They're 12 years old. They're complete assholes. That's exactly what happens. Oh, my own kids? No, they don't care. I don't think my kids even know I'm a cage fighter yet. Mm-hmm. Oh, I look slow. I looked slow when I was wrestling. I was an Olympic wrestler, but I was super slow. Mm-hmm. And then even when he's bragging about, like Logan saying how there's levels to this game of wrestling and how he was a really good wrestler, but then this one guy beat him and he realized how good that guy was. And he's like, were you on that guy's level? And he's like, that guy didn't even win states. I was an Olympic wrestler. That guy couldn't, I would do to that guy what he did to you. But like with no ego in it. It's just incredible. I watched the whole thing and I don't think I've ever watched a full podcast before, but he is so you cannot knock him off of who he is because he's just accepted his losses and doesn't fight you on them and doesn't deny it.
Yeah.
And it was really interesting to watch. It's like, oh, this is what being really confident looks like. It's not thinking you're the best at everything. Mm-hmm. It's going, oh, I'm 100% slow twitch. I was the slowest guy on the wrestling team. Mm-hmm. Just saying it, just stating it without fighting back at all when they try to pick on your negatives. And they're not insecurities. Like his weaknesses aren't insecurities because he doesn't try to fight you on them. He just accepts that they're truth.
Yeah.
So it was really interesting to watch.
Yeah. He answers, which is a technique, and it's not a foolproof every time. It's not, you can do it all the time. So I don't want you to think that, but taking a pointed like question that is meant insultingly, like, do your kids make fun of you, and answering it literally,
mm-hmm.
and like just refusing to buy into the frame that I'm supposed to be upset by this question, and instead is, it's demoralizing for, and then Logan isn't, he's just, I'm sure.
No, they said
teasing
so.
Him.
No, dude, it was amazing. The guy's trying to tease him, go, you're, it's so, I'm trying so hard to not like you.
Yeah.
And now I don't even know if I want Jake to win, because I like you so much. Like, I'm trying to get under your skin, and you aren't, I don't want to be mean to you anymore because of the way you're responding. They literally say these things to him throughout the course of the podcast. He goes, I don't even want to fuck with you anymore. This is like, you're just handling this so well that I want to be nice to you.
You know, what's interesting is that, like, if you are bullying, and Logan is teasing him, I don't think he's entertaining for the purposes of a podcast, but if someone is bullying you, they need fire. Like, something needs to continue to mm-hmm. make them do it. And so what it can be, weakness can fuel bullies, pushback and rage when they know they can overwhelm you can, but that, like, the unflappable literal response is just like, how long can your fire burn? Because I'm not feeding it. I'm not giving it it needs to continue.
I just did this Jonah Hill video on how to stand up for yourself. And so I was researching how to stand up to bullies. And I ended up going a different direction because I went with how to deal with your friends. But there's this guy, who knows how credible he is, but he tours schools giving anti-bullying speeches. And it's the exact technique he gives. He has people come up and try to bully him.
Yeah.
And the first time he does it, he fights back. And it's very easy to keep bullying
him.
They do not stumble.
Yeah.
And the second time, he doesn't fight back. He kind of acknowledges what they said. He acknowledges his weaknesses. And these high school kids who were just having they had infinite ammo to keep teasing him, run out of things to say. And they start to stutter, and they're holding the microphone, and they go, well, thanks. And they just stare at him. He goes, okay, cool. So that's the end of the exercise. I win.
Yeah.
And the kid knew that their job was to keep making fun of him, but they just don't have the fuel added. So I don't know. Horrible bullying. Maybe it's not the answer. I don't even pretend to know what to do when you're getting the shit kicked out of you in school every day. But this is just interesting from a conversational perspective. I think most people, they get teased by their friends or acquaintances in their friend group. And Ben Askren just does. I mean, he literally takes a room of people who are trying to, in a friendly way, bully him, and makes them all really like him. And it's amazing that they just speak out loud. They just say, I have no desire to keep trying to be mean to you. You have completely ruined this game for me.
Yeah.
So it was very interesting to watch. I would do a breakdown on it, but
it's a frame thing.
Saturday.
It's a frame thing. Like, what they're saying is, we're in a fight and I just sucker punched you. That's the frame. Like, I just got first swing. And he comes back with, we're not even fighting.
Yeah.
And it's just like, whoa, that's demoralizing.
Well,
like,
we're not fighting, like, and your sucker punch, I didn't even feel it.
Didn't even hurt
me. So we're not fighting. I'm not punching you back. But two, that meant nothing to me.
Yeah,
that swing you just took was a gentle breeze on my face.
Yeah, so it's not just, it doesn't just stop him. Like, it does establish a bit of a pecking order, which is just mm-hmm. like, you can't hurt me.
Yeah. And all the comments are talking about how, I love Ben Askren now, and he comes off so humble.
This is what real confidence looks like in his previous fights. And obviously, he knew that he was playing heel and he was coming over from Bellator, but he was so unlikable.
I saw him talk about that too. It's actually pretty fascinating how that knee shaped his whole career. He had just beaten Robbie Lawler, and if he had beaten Jorge Masvidal, he would have gotten a shot at the title.
He barely beat Robbie Lawler.
It doesn't matter though. That's the thing. If he beats Robbie Lawler, barely beats him, almost loses. But that's a top X guy at the time. Jorge Masvidal is a top X guy at the time. And then I think Jorge Masvidal got a title fight shortly thereafter.
Sure. We don't need to talk. I mean, every fucking podcast talks about MMA.
Oh, no, I'm just saying it's interesting to talk. He's gone. Ben Askren is completely retired.
Yeah.
Because of that one. And I mean, he didn't get mauled. He took one shot, one bad shot.
Yeah.
And it ended his whole career.
Well, he seemed outclassed in the UFC. He seemed like he shouldn't be there. And I think he would have gotten mauled at the top of it.
Well, Dana does not like him. Immediately after Jorge, he put him against Damian Maia, the best grappler in the UFC. Yeah.
Just beat him up. Well, it's okay. You're such a good... This is your thing. You grapple, right? Not really. Like,
well, but that what I'm saying is you could easily have fed him the right strikers to have gotten him all the way to a belt.
If it were Conor McGregor, Dana could have done a nicer... paired him against people that
no, he wasn't better. Habib. He wasn't Habib Nurmagomedov, but it's just fascinating to me. You didn't get... Because when I think of him, I think of a washed-up fighter that got stomped a bunch and then left. Because, that's not actually what happened. You took a bad knee and didn't even fight the guy. And then you lost to Damian Maia, who's literally considered the best MMA grappler of all time, potentially. And then you retired.
Damian Maia's gotten beat by a lot of people. by a lot of people. And he's old.
Strikers.
He's old, too. He's, I mean, Ben Askren can't hang in the UFC. That's the truth. He's just not good enough.
He could have gotten a title, I think.
He might have lucked into a title shot if he beat up.
He could have Eddie Alvarez'd it. He could have held the belt.
Yeah, yeah, that's
for sure.
Yeah, and then Eddie is now in Bellator, right?
I don't know.
Anyways, what else? Do we have questions?
Yep.
So yeah, if you want to know how to be incredibly likable, come off as extremely confident, and potentially deal with teasing, watch Ben Askren on the Logan Paul podcast.
Mm-hmm. All right. First one is, I'm a fairly attractive guy, quite flirty, and extremely oblivious to when women are interested. I recently read Models and How to Tell If They Are Interested, and the How to Tell If They Are Interested section was an eye-opener. Now, this hasn't been a problem in my dating life. However, this is very problematic with friendships. I meet many fantastic women I'm not interested in that I want to be friends with, and after a while, they'll get cold and distant. Looking back, they had many signs of interest and backed off when they started dating someone else. Notably, I haven't had the same issue with gay men. How can you flirt with the world while still keeping things platonic?
So I think it's to, one of the things you can do is, you can friend zone them, which is to like talk about friends of yours that they might like to go on a date with, which is like one very concrete way. Like, oh my gosh, you should meet my whatever friend. You guys might get along. You can talk about dates that you are going on that you are excited about. Like this is you treat them explicitly like a friend, because what happens in the opening stages of flirting is there's this like, am I interested in you? Are we? Like, I'm available. And so you just like, I am not available. And like, I have someone else for you. That type of stuff tends to allow you to be playful and flirty and still be friends.
Yeah, I agree. Just friends with them. I mean, I really should just find a video from someone who talks about, it could be a man or a woman, how to friend zone someone. And then just
do people make videos on how to friend zone people?
Probably.
How to maintain friends?
I think so.
And I think it's kind of, I'll just give you a couple other things. Do the, like, when you're inviting them out, invite them out in groups. Like, do the opposite of date stuff. Like, if you're going to go out to get drinks one-on-one with a date, invite them out with a group of people to go bowling that are of mixed, you know, guys and girls.
Yeah, and just treat them, I mean, really just treat them like a friend of the same gender, which is to say, mm-hmm. I get that you're flirting with the world. You can flirt with the world in a platonic way with men as well. But when you touch them, just touch them like they're a male friend. Don't have a lingering touch. Don't make sexual jokes. If you're going to compliment them in the way that you would a guy. Like, I have guy friends who I will say they look handsome. So if you see them and you're telling them they look beautiful, just use the same tone that you would for a guy friend. And really, if you do that, I think you'll be fine. I think flirting with the world is actually a different type of flirting than flirting with someone you're attracted
to. It's flirting
with someone you're attracted to, you are adding tension, sexual tension. Just don't do that when you're flirting with a female friend. And the same way that I don't think you do that with your male friends would be my guess.
Flirting with the world is a synonym would be playful and non-literal.
Making jokes, touching, smiling.
And flirting with someone that you're interested in has what Ben described as this element of like lingering eye contact, tension, heart racingness that is just not at all necessary to be playful with someone. So, yeah.
Next is, I've recently gotten a new girlfriend and we've been dating for 3 months. And in that time, I've gotten to know her a lot closer recently. She has opened up about some trauma. Specifically her mom passing away last year, her injury, which might make her drop out of D1 college sports, and is still dealing with being raped a couple years ago. I have slowly come to realize that I'm not really looking for a relationship at this time in my life, and I want to be focused on developing my career. I'm 22, but still have one more year of college, and also that's not really related to her situation. She really doesn't have anyone else in her life that is a strong emotional support right now, since her only real friend is going through a lot right now as well. I was wondering how you would deal with this situation and what your ideas are about the situation. And if you want more info, I'd be happy to provide it.
How long have they been dating? I forget.
Three months.
3 months. So I'll start at the end. You don't want to stay in relationships out of guilt is a big one. You are not doing them a favor, certainly not long term, because you are eventually going to either resent them or just get out after they become more attached to you.
Mm-hmm.
And so... Go ahead.
But this person also didn't say they want to end the relationship necessarily. They just said they don't want a serious relationship. So my first question would be, what do you want?
Yeah,
are you looking for casual dating? Are you looking to be friends? Have you decided you don't like this person and you want them out of your life? Like, how you behave is going to be completely different based on what outcome you're looking for.
So a good question to ask yourself is, assuming that this person would be really happy with any sort of outcome, what is your ideal for them? Is it like, we hang out less, we hang out this, we hang out that? And then the second thing, which I would say, is like, tell them that, you know, hey, I'm looking to focus on work. And let's say, for instance, that what you want to do is have a more casual relationship. Like, hey, I'm looking to focus on work. I don't think I'm going to have or even want to spend the same amount of time like hanging out, all these other things. If you want to continue, I like you and I would like to see you in a more casual setting. But if you don't want to, I totally understand. Like, you just figure out what your ideal scenario is and then you speak to them about it.
Yeah.
Because it does take two engaged, happy people to make a good relationship, and not just two people who are physically present, especially given that there's no children and it's only been 3 months, and you are like, people are going to be at difficult times in their life when you decide that you don't want to give them what they perceive to need from you or what you think that they need from you. You also just might be over imagining what this person needs from you. So,
yeah, what I would say is, you say what you want. She says what she wants. If they overlap, then you do what you both want. And if there's a gap, then you part ways and try to find people who meet you where you want. So if you say, I want a casual relationship, she says, I'm really looking for something serious. You say, I think you're awesome. That's not me. So I think we should stop seeing each other. Yeah. And then do you want to stay friends or not? Because you could say we could stay friends. If you don't want to stay friends, then you don't say that part. It's really just designing, getting clear in yourself what your ideal is. And also, if they don't want your ideal, what your continued relationship ideal is.
Acceptable is. It's kind of like, you just draw a Venn diagram for yourself. You're like, this is what is ideal for me. And within it is what is acceptable and good for me. And then you ask the other, you tell that to the person. Then they say what their ideal and what's acceptable. And if there's overlap, you do the overlap.
And if there's not, then overlap.
Yeah. Like, this is none, our acceptables don't match up.
Yeah. So it's actually, it sounds simple because it is simple. It's not easy necessarily because you might be feeling emotional things like guilt or obligation, but hey, just here's my ideal. Okay. That's not my ideal. Okay. Well, if you're not willing to meet me at my ideal,
here's what's
acceptable. We can still be friends or we can't be or whatever.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I don't want to be your friend. I only want to be your girlfriend because I care about you so much. Okay. Unfortunately, that sounds like then we can't have a relationship at all.
So, I guess as it doesn't need to be broken down this analytically, but if I were to create like a worksheet of it, it would be like, write down your ideal scenario, and then that's your circle. And then it's okay, write down your acceptables, and your acceptables, we are friends, we never speak again. You know what I mean? And like all of this, and you start with your ideal and you ask them to fill out their ideal and you see the overlap. Okay, there's probably none because there's often none in two people's ideal relationships. Mm-hmm. And then you could move on to the acceptables. And then you do the same Venn diagram thing. And on your acceptables, we never speak again. and that's all it takes. That's a trump card. Like, for, you know, my acceptable is you are my boyfriend. Okay, that's it. So we're repeating ourselves, but that's that.
Last one I have is the interview with I was watching the interview with Cosmic Skeptic, and it reminded me of an interview with Brett Weinstein and Jordan Peterson on Joe Rogan. They drew the line between factual truth and useful lie. For example, religion. I personally believe that the Bible is factually wrong. However, I still believe that following the principles and living as a Christian will make your life better. It will make the life of your children better, and it will overall help you to solve a lot of problems that you would otherwise not solve. Jordan Peterson goes deeper into this in his lectures. Basically, the idea is that following the religious rules is a sacrifice for your future and your child's future. Thus, my question is, how do you know that even if something is not necessarily factually true, that if you abandon this idea or set of principles, you will not cause more harm than good?
Well, I actually think you and Jordan Peterson don't believe what you just said. Because what is the Jordan Peterson quote?
He paraphrased. He said, basically, the idea is that following the religious rules is a sacrifice for your future and your children's future.
Yeah, I don't think so, because you don't stone gay people.
Yeah, this is the thing with the Bible, is that we've got this idea that to be a good Christian is the parts that have been cherry-picked over thousands of years, but it's like, read the Bible. There's a lot that is required to be a good Christian. There's people on the promenade near where we live that are Jews who have to wrap every Jew.
Yeah.
I don't know what it's called, but they have to wrap them so that when so that the rapture can happen and all the Jews can go. Like,
yeah, but to this point of what if I throw away the tenets of Christianity, I run the risk of being immoral. And if I follow the tenets of Christianity, it's a sacrifice for a better life. Well, this isn't true. If you followed the tenets of Christianity, you'd be in jail because you would have killed someone.
Well, or I'll give it the best argument. A lot of Christians say, hey, the Old Testament can essentially be thrown out because Christ came and gave us a new pact. And the Old Testament is where a lot of the stuff is. But the greater point is
are you having sex before marriage?
Yes. Yeah. There's the
if you're having sex before marriage, then you're going to hell. Like
you have layered on top of the Bible a filter, undoubtedly. Like you do not live, no one except for perhaps the Westboro Baptist Church is looking at this for like literal every word counts and we need to treat them all evenly. So when you say that the principles of being a good Christian, I would argue that you did not derive those from the Bible. While some of them may be echoed and contained in the Bible, they are in interaction with your filter as to what you find acceptable in the Bible, and there are good things in there. But if you were an alien and you had no idea of what was right and wrong, and you had the Bible as your only text through which to live a good life, I think you'd be in deep, deep doo-doo. But if you take what has been distilled down over time and is like, you know, turn the other cheek, these are all in the Bible and they're all solid ways to live. And I think your life is going to be better for it. But I think it's a mistake to say that these generate from the Bible. The Bible's it's almost like an encyclopedia of different ways to live and things to do and how to handle shellfish and all that kind of stuff. So was there another question about Jordan Peterson and throwing it out? I guess what I'm saying is it's tough for me to arrive at the same conclusion of the question because I disagree on the premise, which is that the Bible is telling you how to live. I actually don't think it is.
Yeah.
I think you're bringing your own morality to the Bible and looking at and exempting everything that doesn't fit that and saying this isn't what being a good Christian is. It's like it's actually your own morality that is making the Bible such a beacon of positivity.
Yeah, that's my high level answer. So the question is, how do I be a good person if I'm not following the Bible? And my answer is, you're already being a good person
and not following the Bible. Yeah.
If you were to literally follow the Bible, even the New Testament, if your neighbor were to do that, I think you would not deem them a good person.
And the question is, I mean, have you read it cover to cover? Because if not, how could you possibly be following it? You're only following the summary that is, and what the important pieces of the Bible, by the way, throughout history have changed. Like, you know, at one point it was very important to handle apostates a certain way and have crusades a certain way. And these were all justified in the Bible. And depending on whether you're Protestant or Catholic, Peter was the rock on which it's built. So the Pope has divine power. Or if you're Protestant, that part of the Bible doesn't really count. So, yeah. The other thing, I think I've mentioned it. I talked on the podcast about the lessons of the Bible and how I disagree with Jordan Peterson's charitable interpretations of many.
No, I don't think you've talked about that.
So I don't know if I've talked about it. I'd love to ask him this question. I think I have said it once. Justin's probably heard it. When I read Genesis for the first time, one of the things that I took from it is like, you know, you get eventually to Cain and Abel and you say, oh, wow, the first murderer ever, according to the Bible, is Cain. And everybody knows that who has read the Bible. But the question is, who is the first liar in the history of the universe? And if you read the first 10 to 12 pages, you will see it is God. God says, if you eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, you will surely die this day. And he makes it clear in a sort of inner soliloquy, inner monologue that he has, that he's like, oh no, they've eaten from it even though I told them not to. If they eat from the tree of power, they will surely become like me. So what I take from that as I read it is like, and the snake, by the way, the devil is the one who says, that's not true. If you eat from it, you will become as God. You will get the knowledge of good and evil. You will have morality that is separate from this person who is dictating it to you. And you will decide, for instance, that you don't want to run around naked and have him peeping Tom you. And so when I read this, it's like really tough for me not to see like God is this authoritarian, blindfolding, manipulative liar figure. And it almost in that first few pages says, don't trust this entire book. We're going to tell you that the devil is the snake, but the snake told you the truth, you know, like, and if the truth is good, it wasn't coming from God. He tried to hide it from you because he wanted control over you. And then when you acted out against him, he cursed women and with pain, and he said all these rules, and he cast down the devil, who you're going to be the lowest of animals because you told him the truth, and he gave men all of these hardships. And it's right there at the beginning. And I don't know how you view that and go like, this is the guy that I need to have on my side looking out for me, and I need to serve him as anything other than a cruel master. So when I read it metaphorically, that's what I get. And I'd love to, it seems like when Sam Harris brings this point out, he talks about the way that Jordan Peterson reads the Bible. If you were to read a cookbook and you say there are three eggs, oh, that's the Trinity of purity. And, you know, he does all of this. And he says, if you're willing to bring that level of intense analysis and your own filter on top of it, you can find value in cookbooks that give really good life advice. But the question is, was the life advice in the cookbook and the three eggs, and that's the three parts of goodness, or was the value something that you brought to it? So I think that Sam Harris has the right of it there. I think that
you wrote a college paper on that, right?
Yeah, not really. I wrote a college paper on Gilgamesh and how similar, like if you look at Horus and Gilgamesh and the beginning of, and Jesus in those cases, how they're the same myth sort of.
Yeah. I remember when you ran me through that. I was a theist. I remember when you ran me through this. You're like, guess who the first liar in the Bible is? It's like, yeah. I don't know, Cain? Like, nope. God.
You read it, man.
Blew my mind.
You can read it for yourself. It won't take a lot of time.
Well, no, I knew the story.
It'll take 7 minutes.
Dude, here's the thing. I knew the story, but I was told the story as a child.
Yeah.
So I was told who the good guys and the bad guys were, and I was five.
Yeah, and then we argue over who's so bad. Was it Adam or Eve? Well, Eve told him to eat it, but Adam decided to. It's like, it was truth.
Yeah, yeah.
Eve pointed Adam towards truth. He got the truth. They decided that, hey, this naked thing where you look at us all day is kind of messed up. I don't want you doing that anymore. And God's like,
no, I remember when you told me it. It blew my mind. Because I'd never questioned it for the first 19 years of my life.
And another tree, which is the tree of power. And if they eat that, not only will they have knowledge, they will have power. They will become like me. I cannot have that. Jesus. It's just like, what an abusive relationship. And why does he get to do it? Because he created you. I mean, can you imagine if your parents, who created you, came around and said, look, they lied to you your whole life. You find the truth. You're finally starting to get empowered. And then they kick you out of the house and damn you and curse you. And then the only solution is to pray to them, asking their forgiveness all the time because you are born into sin. It's just so screwy to me. Anyways, I know that we have a lot of religious listeners, and I know that it probably you find it this way. I don't mean to insult anyone personally, but the story is to me so mean in so many ways. And if you take the positive pieces of this very thick book, and you live a good life and you think it comes from the book, fine. But I would actually give you more credit. I think that those positive pieces come from you and the book is very mixed. So yeah. Anything else?
No, I already said my piece.
All right.
Well, the question was actually,
sorry, I got off of it.
Yeah. The question was basically, how do you know when self-deception is useful or not? We kind of talked about it in
yes.
the podcast.
So self-deception is very useful. It's often, I mean, how do you know when it's useful? I don't know that that's the right question. Like, it's useful all the time. It's useful to treat every gun as if it's loaded. It's useful to treat every sexual partner as if they have, I guess not AIDS, but like an STD that you do not want to get. It's useful to, there's many useful things, but that presumes that here's the problem, that you know the goal and the best course of action. And the promise of truth is that, look, this might not be useful to your purposes, but it is the case. And so even though you might not survive best, even though you might not get what you want, this is the case.
Well, self-deception is also a double-edged sword, and I've seen this. So you might think to yourself, oh yeah, well, I can think of times when self-deception helps me. But what you don't see are the times that it really hurts you. It's easy to see in other people when someone is in a physically abusive relationship, but they go, no, he loves me and he'll change. And that was a one-time thing and whatever the self-deception is that keeps them in the relationship. But what you don't see is all the ways that you're doing it yourself and your own life is worse for the lies you tell yourself. So that's the thing. It's easy to go, yeah, well, if you act like the gun is always loaded, then you'll be careful. But if you have a policy of self-deception, you won't catch all the self-deceptions. And actually, the most dangerous ones are the ones where you don't know that you're lying to yourself. And so you will have things you lie to yourself about that make your life worse and that harm you. Versus if you try, if you strive to, and none of us do it, we all have self-deception. But if you strive to root them out and have as few as possible, I believe that what you lose with losing the fact that every gun is loaded, you more than gain, that you net out to be better off with no self-deception, because you can still have a responsible gun policy, which is I'm just not going to point guns at other people, loaded or otherwise. Yeah. I don't need to pretend they're loaded. I just know sometimes they're loaded and I don't know it. So I never point them at other people. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then on the flip side, you've removed the self-deception that keeps you at the job you hate, in the abusive relationship, whatever it might be. And I just think that it's really hard, borderline impossible to remove the harmful self-deceptions and keep the good ones. I think you have to just try to root them all out and then trust yourself to know a gun might not be loaded, but still not pointing at people because it might be loaded.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we tell, you know, kids, we say, everything is heuristic. Don't talk to strangers. Like, why do we tell them that? There's an implicit, like, strangers are bad. It's like, no, but they could be. Like, you know, always look both ways before crossing the road. Even when it's nighttime and I don't see headlights, you know, do I have to? We live by these heuristics because they keep us alive. And we ingrain those ones don't necessarily have truth claims about the world, but they are implicit in that it is dangerous if you cross the street without always looking both ways. But the bigger one and that you're saying is this is where you get really metaphysical, is that sort of what you're saying is like you'll be better off. But the truth doesn't necessarily make that promise. Like, as long as you are committed to your vision of what is good for you, you create space for self-deception. And I have this and everybody has this. But as long as you think like, look, it's best for me to like keep making money and have this job, or it's like it's best for me to like be protected and stay in my group of friends, or it's best for me to view myself as an ego and a separate entity for the rest of the world and to realize that I was really one with everything would be ego death and whatever. Then I would die because I wouldn't feed myself. As long as you have that, you create space for self-deception. So we all have it. You're not going to get rid of it. But probably, to Ben's point, if you lean off of it, you'll actually see that things get much better.
Mm-hmm.
And I truly believe that, at least in the medium term, like if people had less self-deception in their lives, things get much better. But there's probably a point at which you realize that your ego is an illusion and you just stop eating and then you die. And you could say that things are now worse off for that body. But I guess then your spirit goes into the, you know, I don't know what happens at that point. I'm just making it up. Cool.
Yeah. I also think that like I said, with the gun example, I just think that the idea that you need to deceive yourself in order to be moral, have gun safety, whatever the example is, I just don't buy. I actually think you can get to the same result without the deception.
Mm-hmm. Well, sorry, let's just come back. I just want to make sure that I answered it. What was the final question?
The final question was, so my question is, how do you know that even if something is not necessarily factually true, that if you abandon this idea or set of principles, you will not cause more harm than good?
Mm. So here's, implicit in your idea of harm and good are truth claims about the world. That harm is when people scream and cry, and good is when they say they feel good, and dying is bad, and living bountifully is good. So if you go to like the root bottom of this question, it's that you don't know any of those things. You know what I mean? You might be deceiving yourself for all of those things. So if you were to truly ask questions about all of that, you might just totally redefine harm and good. But I think that that's beyond the level at which you're asking. The short answer is, most of the time when you let go of self-deception, even in the world as we view it with the values that we have, it will help you. That's just my life experience.
Mm-hmm.
You could take it from me or not. I don't have a great answer. I've seen it be the case.
Yeah, anecdotally, I mean, the people I see who the self-deception that they have, that they don't know they have, are keeping them in bad relationships, they are stunting their growth in business, stunting their career success, like even forgetting the enlightenment thing, in the physical world, their results are worse. And when they release their self-deception, that's when they get into a better relationship, leave the shitty one. are able to finally be a successful entrepreneur because they were able to acknowledge their flaws and work on them.
Yeah.
And their self-deception was making them think they were already good at business. So now their business sucks, but when they see the self-deception, they know what they need to train, and now, bam, they're making more money. So just in terms of what most people define as physical results, health, wealth, relationships, all of the anecdotal evidence I have.
It's always better when you release self-deception.
No one I know is more financially successful or in a better relationship than, or sorry, because of their lies to themselves.
Well, so, and what always, in all of those cases, though, there's a dip. Things get worse. That's why the self-deception is there. It's to protect you from that dip where you go from thinking you're a great entrepreneur, selling how to be really good at entrepreneurship, and then you go, oh shit, I'm not that good. I shouldn't be selling this. I have to learn how to be good. Now I'm not making as much money. But in that time, I've learned how to be really good. I come out the other side and I'm better for it. One example that we haven't had to deal with, fortunately, we've talked about religious communities, is like, look, let's say that you're in a religious community and you're teetering on the edge of falling out of faith.
I do have an example of this. The only person I know who is personally who's left the Mormon church is really happy they did it. Now, I'm not saying that that's a guarantee. This is what I'm saying. I have anecdotal experience of people realizing self-deception. Only one of them was in a extremely tight religious community. But I've asked him, and he said he's really grateful that he stopped self-deceiving himself and has left that community.
And what's interesting is that...
It doesn't mean... It's not guaranteed. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. But I actually do know someone that's had that, and they're pretty hyped that they're not in the...
Didn't he say that his wife, who is now, he's now not, because it was an arranged marriage, had the same realizations as him, and but then came to the conclusion, it's like, look, I'm just going to join this and play along because...
She likes the community aspect. Yeah, but she's still, but she's not keeping... It's kind of like the gun safety thing. She doesn't have the belief that the community is wholly right in their religious beliefs, but just chooses to live in it because she prefers it.
Yeah. So the curse of knowledge, which... For her, she might go, I wish I didn't know. But she's like, whatever. I could
she
just
kept
pretend.
Her friends. That's what I'm saying. She kept her friends. She kept her family. Yeah. She's going to get remarried to someone in the Mormon community.
Yeah.
And he left.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Cool.
That's it.
All right. Patreon?
Yep.
All right. If you guys enjoyed this, please hop over to our Patreon. We're going to do a bunch more questions. And you see, they often spiral into topics that you would see us cover here on the podcast. So if you want to check that out, any amount gets you into Patreon. And, keeps Justin paid and keeps the podcast going. So hope to see you there. Later.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.